The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Welcome to the weekly podcast from Radio Today. A treat coming up this week. I've been chatting to Rod Sharp to mark the 25th anniversary of 5 Live this week. Rod has been on Up All Night since the first night the station launched. And as you may or may not know, he's hosted it from Marblehead in Massachusetts for the last 15 years or so. Who says you need to be in the TSA of the station you're broadcasting on, eh? The wonders of modern technology. Yes, okay. Speaking of which, Radio Today's founder and editor, Roy Martin, is on the line utilising modern technology for our usual quick look at what's making headlines in the industry this week. And it's been fairly quiet, relatively speaking.
Yeah, I suppose if you compare it with the first, 8 or 9 weeks of 2019, then it has been quite quiet. We've had a couple of radio stations sold. Of course, it seems to be a weekly event at the moment. This time we're in Scotland, Original 106 in Aberdeen and Five's Kingdom FM. Sold to DC Thompson, which owns Wave FM in Dundee, of course. Which is an interesting move. Nobody saw it coming, especially as we had the...
We had Adam on the podcast a few weeks ago.
Yeah, the week before, and he, I wouldn't like to play poker with him, I tell you. That was an interesting move. And some saying the group is probably the largest independent Scottish-based radio group with a radio station called Wave FM or something like that. That puts them, as the rumour mill has already started, it makes them big enough and... ugly enough to be bought by one of the bigger groups and rolled out with a national network. So
yeah,
let's hope that's a long time off. They're saying at the moment,
I think the stations will retain their identities and the local programs for each market, but it means they can make some cost savings behind the scenes, I guess. So the kind of the things that all the groups did at first when they bought more stations, it's finally happening for these ones. Some other news this week, Simon Cole is leaving 7 Digital. Farewell to Simon, a radio guy through and through, of course.
Yeah, top radio guy. He set up UBC. I always get that confused with UCB with his partner in crime, Tim, way back when. So they've obviously worked on their exit strategy recently and come up with that. So good luck to Simon. And all the best for his other business opportunities, Standard Line, that he's now going to concentrate on.
There's been an update for BBC Sounds this week. So finally, we can restart programs. You couldn't ever do this on the iPlayer radio app. You could always do it on the browser version on a desktop. Mm. But you can now rewind a live radio program like you can on the TV iPlayer and say, I want to start this show at the beginning. I've missed the first half hour.
Oh, yeah. And good news for you, because you're always complaining that it doesn't have CarPlay. And they've said that it's going to be coming soon. CarPlay.
One of the new features.
Great.
I might finally start using BBC Sounds. Maybe. Interestingly, this piece from podnews.net, James Cridland's site, about Google having dropped the BBC podcasts because they don't want to comply with what they're asking them.
I think the less said about this, the better. People are thinking, what, you're removing yourself from Google? Google is the internet. So if you're not on Google, do you even exist? So a bit of a bizarre move, and hopefully that'll all get sorted out and everybody will be happy again.
Hey, the Ofcom bulletin was an interesting read. It went on for pages and pages this week.
There's about 20 pages on George Galloway. So as you do when you've got a story like that to write up on Radio Today, you start reading it and then you start writing the story in your head and then you start putting words down. And then you get to about page 17 where George basically slags off the breakfast show presenter on his own station and Ofcom. You think, oh, hang on a minute, the headline's totally different now. So that took a while, but we got there in the end with that. If you want to explain exactly what it was.
Well, I think it's probably easier to read it on radiotoday.co.uk. It's very complicated. You said, George getting his own say on the complaint as well, which is an interesting move. Alan Brazil had a complaint upheld about him on TalkSport as well. Again, you can read the full story on radiotoday.co.uk. And also look out on the site Wednesday, because there's some news coming from Global, we think.
Yes, Richard Park has been away due to an illness, and we got some details about his future on the website, radiotoday.co.uk.
Excellent. Here's an opportune moment just to tell you about CleanFeed. If you haven't tried it yet, if you're going to be working from home, doing the show from somewhere different or whatever, it's a really simple way to connect live audio over the web in great quality, and you can even record within the browser. It's free to get started, completely free version. It'll take you 30 seconds to sign up, and you could be on your show from somewhere different to normal within a few minutes. Find out more at cleanfeed.net. Roy, you're going to your first radio conference of the year next week, somewhere nice.
Switzerland, in fact, off to Radio Days Europe, which is in Lausanne. So I'm going to fire up the car and drive over the weekend and get there and then be reporting back on Monday and Tuesday from Radio Days in Europe. So keep an eye on radiotodaylive.com. Everything's going to be on that page. Tweets from other people, videos, audio interviews, the whole thing, anything Radio Days Europe related will be on radiotodaylive.com. So just keep a tab open on your browser if you're working, and you can keep up to date with who's saying what at the conference.
It's the Hospital Radio Conference and the awards this weekend as well. They're in Stoke, so good luck to anybody there. It's going to be Radio Festival soon. I've just booked my train tickets this week. That's May the 13th, Radio Audio
Very
Week.
Very good.
There's Tuning In and Young Areas and the Podcast Awards as well. And not next week, the week after is NAB Show in Las Vegas. You going to that one?
I couldn't get the time off. The boss is quite stingy on
getting time off. That guy
actually,
who owns Radio Today, so mean.
Yeah. So I just had to put up with Switzerland instead of Vegas. But who knows, maybe next year.
Yeah, well, there's going to be some guys there from various UK companies. We're going to try and hook up with some of them on the podcast in a couple of weeks from NAB. So if you're going to be out there, get in touch with us, tell us, and you could be joining our kind of hookup with the States, with Vegas, on the podcast in a couple of weeks. Get in touch and let us know. We're at Radio Today on Twitter. Just tweet us. Coming up, James Cridland on why you shouldn't make assumptions about technology. David Lloyd's Radio Moments coming up as well. And that's all on the way after Rod Sharp next on the Radio Today programme. Thank you, Roy.
Is that Pat's brother?
It's his dad, I think.
Yeah, carry on.
Broadcast Bionics brings you Phone Box, Oasis, Virtual Director and many more innovative solutions for creative radio people. Come to bionics.co.uk and find out more.
This is the Radio Today programme. Still to come in David Lloyd's Radio Moments this week, we're going to hear the launch of BBC Radio 5 Live 25 years ago this week. And as some regular listeners might know, as well as doing this podcast, I do a bit of freelance work in the newsroom at 5 Live. And one of the highlights for me is reading the news on Up All Night. Well, the man who created the show still hosts it three nights a week, as he has done for 25 years, is the legend Rod Sharp. And I'm delighted to say he's on the podcast with us this week. Hello, Rod.
Hello, Stuart. Well, it's very nice of you to call me a legend. I've always got a little reservation when I hear that. It either means I'm on the way out, feet first, or in some other way. But I love it anyway. I'm very happy.
It's nice to chat to you in more detail rather than just say thank you, Rod, when you introduce me with the news
I know. Well, I think you're enormously good to come and do these overnight shifts in the newsroom, because I think after any length of time, it scrambles the brain, and that's a lot to ask of one. So thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And we'll talk about you being up all night or not in a little while and where you are in the world. But I wanted to start back in the early 90s in BH, because there was this Scud FM, as it was known, Radio 4 News FM, around the first Gulf War. And that was kind of the catalyst for 5 Live. And you were there in the newsroom watching all this happen at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. Now, Scud FM, I think, was just an absolutely brilliant piece of improvisation. Because in my memory, since about 1990, there'd been all this talk about us having to have a continuous news service, and basically the BBC having to do a CNN. But of course, being television, it just took forever. You know, people couldn't agree on how this should be. But then events rather took over. So we have this Operation Desert Storm, the move against Saddam Hussein. I mean, in a way, I think it's Saddam Hussein's responsibility, because he invaded Kuwait, and then a year later, of course, Desert Storm. And to cover Desert Storm in a different way, I think the moving force here, I mean, there were people like Bill Rogers, Phil Longman, they were senior editors. They weren't just editors in the newsroom. You know, they pulled the newsroom into it. I was a foreign desk editor, so I sort of worked for the newsroom and for current affairs. But in those days, there was still a real divide between news and current affairs. So you got this wonderful coming together of people who really wanted to do something. I wasn't directly involved, but I do vividly remember the kind of work that people were doing for Scud. And they would just sit there and talk. And some of our correspondents were on for hours. I do mean literally hours, just absolutely digging into their vast storehouse of knowledge and talking and talking and talking about whatever it was, you know, some tank or something like that. There was a lot of filling. And we suddenly learned that radio, instead of being something very, very concise and beautifully scripted, beautifully, beautifully thought out, had to be this long and rather amorphous sort of a thing. And that was a complete change. It was a shock to the BBC.
At the time, Radio 5 was fairly young. It was kind of this mishmash station of sport and children's and comedy and all sorts of things.
Well, that's right. Do you remember? I remember so well the kind of the mismatch, as you say, of children's in there with everything else. You couldn't work it out. And our friend John Inverdale was one of the first hosts on Radio 5. And I thought, gosh, John's got a good job. And then I thought about it a bit more. And I thought, this is really quite tricky, fitting in with all this stuff. So a little bit later, in the absence of Scud, people started to think, well, we could do this, you know, we could do a news station. John Burt was the boss. There wasn't necessarily the money, but suddenly, I think it was Tony Hall who really kind of pushed this along when he was a director of news, and he suddenly, the money was there, and it all had to be done in an incredibly short time. It was like, in my memory, it was 6 weeks. I'm sure it wasn't exactly 6 weeks, but you got people going out in the road. Wonderful Bill Rogers went out in the road, discovered talent all over the place, discovered Jane in Gloucestershire or somewhere like that, you know, and just pulled her out. He went to every single BBC local radio station, listened to the talent, made his decisions, and came back with people like Jane Garvey. And meanwhile, of course, back at HQ, Jenny was fielding letters from hopefuls like me, and I don't know what the hell I was thinking about. I could have done anything. I could have said, look, Jenny, I've got this great idea for an afternoon show. But oh no, I had to go, Jenny, I've got this brilliant idea for a show in the middle of the night.
And that was from your kind of work with the foreign correspondents, because they were telling you that they weren't getting on the air very much.
I thought they weren't getting on the air very much. Having lived in California for a long time, I had naturally a soft spot for the West Coast and a soft spot for Australia, which I knew a bit, and for other places, you know, Japan, India. I could see that we could do a lot more with our far-flung correspondents than we were actually doing. And they were up for it. You know, this was in the days before everybody was a News 24, as they called it first, you know, correspondent. And people wanted to get on the radio. So I said, look, we could make really good use of our correspondents. And by and large, we actually did. It was a golden time because there was no competition from BBC 24-hour TV news. That hadn't launched yet.
And so that first night, March 1994, do you remember anything about it and the build-up to your first show?
Yeah. Well, of course, I remember the kind of the duplicity that went into the business of putting us on the air last. There we were. And we should have been, in my humble opinion, the first program out since we were there at 2 o'clock. I mean, when the show started, it was 3 hours long. It went from 2 till 5. Duplicity is not the right word, but you know what I mean. The BBC will always do things the way that it wants to do them for the best impact. So they weren't going to launch a station at 2 o'clock in the morning, let's be honest, even if it was a 24-hour news station. So they launched it quite sensibly at 5 o'clock in the morning. So wonderful Jane Garvey was the first voice on the air with Morning Reports, which to this day is still Morning Reports. She goes on the air at 5 a.m. We march through the day. The last program on the air the next day at 2 a.m. is up all night. So we've got this kind of conflicted personality from the get-go, because the Radio Times proclaims that, let us say, the 29th of March doesn't actually begin until 5 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, when did we launch? I haven't an idea. I have no idea whether it was the 28th of March or the 29th, but we got on anyway, and we never fell off.
You're live on 5. I'm Rod Sharp. We're up all night. All over Britain, it's 2:06, and we're only getting started. In New York, it's 9:06. It's 8:06 in Atlanta, 7:06 up in the mountains in Denver, and 6:06 in Seattle. And do you know what? All these times are an hour out since we changed the clock. It's 5:06 in Seattle for the next week's most unfortunate, and Los Angeles. But still, the main story in America tonight is the damage wrought by the storms which swept through 5 southern states last night. Now, among the unsung pleasures of working at night is the eccentric delight for those of us who work in the middle of some of our bigger cities of picking up the first edition of the morning paper, hours and hours before the paper boy is even awake. One of our many missions here on Up All Night is to enable everyone with the radio on to share the joys and the concerns that newspaper editors up and down the country will be bringing to the breakfast table. A short time ago, I phoned Alan Frame, executive editor of the Daily Express, and we talked about the... It's Up All Night on Radio 5 Live. I'm Rod Sharp on 909 and 693 Medium Wave. This is News and Sport from the BBC, 24 hours a day.
So proud of our team. We had a most wonderful team. We launched, in my opinion, fully formed, like Venus coming out of the water. We were such a lovely program. And right away, we just didn't give anybody any problems. I honestly think that's why we survived. We were relatively trouble-free when a lot of the rest of the output was pretty rough and ready to begin with and needed a bit of knocking about, actually.
And so it was you Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday morning, as you still do now. And I think, was it Richard Dallin who did other days?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. No. I think my original, in fact, I'm sure my original hours or days were Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night. So I went through from Sunday night to Thursday morning. And then my old friend Richard Dallin, who'd actually trained with at the BBC, was recruited from LBC, where he'd been doing the evening show with Angela Rippon. So Richard then, bless his heart, came in and he did Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night. And then I picked up again on Sunday. And we thought that was kind of an equitable division because he got the kind of the fag end of the Saturday night, you know, and doing radio on a Saturday night is a real talent. But we discovered that Richard was a cult in the clubs. And in the great days of the Manchester club scene, they used to go into these kind of chill rooms and listen to Richard, which I thought was fantastic.
Wow. And 5 Live, actually, as you say, it hit the ground running and it did really well. I was looking back at the archive of Sony Award winners in the 90s, and I think, you know, 1995, so first year after it had been on air, it was second in Station of the Year. Yeah. And then, of course, it was gold the following year in 96.
Well, it was gold in 96. Not only that, but Up All Night won a one award. Was silver in Best News and Current Affairs. Imagine that. That's Best News and Current Affairs. We're talking about World at 1, PM, World Tonight, Today, and all of the 5 Live Current Affairs strands. Up All Night was second in Best News and Current Affairs. Guess what was first? 5 Live Drive with John Inverdale. That was a great year.
Yeah, and I think you won a couple of golds as well, 98 and 99 for the kind of evening and night.
Well, that's right. Then they'd invented they created this wonderful an award category. For you. Yes, that's right. Best evening and nighttime news show. So we got gold for a couple of years running.
And some of the contributors that you've had on Up All Night have lasted the distance and been on many, many years. People like Dr. Carl and Wynne Scott with archaeology, Peter Bowes, Bill Nicholson, Philip Eden. Lots of names that regular listeners will recognize.
I know. Philip of fond memory, I mean, who's no longer with us. But, you know, the great thing about Philip was that he was in a sense, he was very far ahead of his time. Because even in the 90s, he and I would be talking about climate change. And I go, well, Philip, what do you think about this global warming thing? And he'd say, well, Rod, it's far too early to say. And don't confuse climate with weather. To this day, if we had Philip Eden, he'd be going, don't confuse climate with weather. But he'd also be seriously alarmed. I mean, these Midwest floods in the US that we've got just now are a phenomenal weather event. The cyclone in southern Africa, these are unparalleled weather events. But to talk about the others for a minute, I mean, I loved Bill, and I love Bill. And I you remind me that I should talk to him because he's now living in happy retirement, having retired from the gig at USA Today. And he comes up to Hull, Massachusetts in the summertime, where he has a summer place. And he's just the loveliest of guy and so humble. And that's what I think is really great about the best news people, is a certain element of humility. I mean, Bill was a Central America troubleshooting editor for a long, long time. The funny thing is, he used to come into the USA Today newsroom with a bag which he'd packed, and it used to weigh, I swear, 10 pounds. And he used to give lessons in packing to the USA Today reporters. And he used to say, if you can pack a bag like this, you can go anywhere, anytime. And that was his ready bag, and he used to keep it ready. And that's a wonderful thing that old reporters used to do.
And you mentioned, obviously, in the 80s, you'd been a freelancer on the West Coast of America. Obviously, you'd got that fascination with stuff going on in the States. And throughout your early years at Five Live, you were there covering the 96 US elections and many other stories as well.
Well, I know. We were very lucky. I mean, the great thing, of course, was that in those days, we were flush with cash because we were being treated as any other radio network. And we got a lot more money per capita than we do these days. You would have loved to be on the Up All Night team in the mid-1990s, because I think there were something like 12 or 14 producers who were all lining up interviews, and we cranked it out. But in 95, we went to Hiroshima, for example. I remember going on Japan Airlines for about 5 days, went to Hiroshima, and did some wonderful stuff around the 50th anniversary of that terrible event. And it was one of the most moving trips I think I've ever had. And I'd like to, this is my mea culpa, you're my confessor today, Stuart. there was this lovely, lovely woman who was our fixer and translator, and we became very friendly. And in an extraordinary display for a Japanese person of hospitality and openness, she brought me to her little house, and she and her daughter and I shared supper together in the house. And I was told this was very, very unusual. And afterwards, her daughter wrote me a long and wonderful letter asking me all sorts of questions, and she'd labored forever over this. And I don't believe that I answered it, and I'm ashamed of myself. And I wish I could go back now and find this letter and find where she is and what she's doing. And, you know, she's probably being an office lady somewhere, and I hope she's doing terribly well.
Lovely. Of course, you reply to every other bit of fan mail you get, don't you? And others, backloads come every week.
Yeah, but you know, there's a funny thing. You know, it's wonderful how we opened up communication in the 1990s, because we would get a lot of letters, and I'd do my best to reply to them. I remember one lady who was a marvelous correspondent, and she had beautiful handwriting. She must have been in her 80s when she started, and she lived in Wimbledon. And she was my, you know how on, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, the great Tim Taylor. Show,
yeah, Mrs. Show. Trellis. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mrs. Trellis from South Wales. She was my real life Mrs. Trellis. And she and I would have this marvelous conversation in letters, going backwards and forwards. And she would explain to me how in the summertime she was sitting out in the back garden and she was listening to Up All Night, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning and the birds were going. It was marvelous stuff. It was really great. I loved that. And then, in the middle of whenever it was, I think 96, I decided we ought to get on this thing called the internet. Mm-hmm. So I remember running a line into the studio in the old extension to Broadcasting House, the old radio two studios actually on Radio 1. John Peel used to broadcast from next door, and we used to sometimes bump into each other in the men's, which was a thrill beyond belief. That was the most I ever had to do with John Peel, but I was, my gosh. Anyway, we ran this line into the studio, and I said, dial up the internet, let's get on the internet. I'd had my own email address and stuff like that, and I created an email, and sure enough, we started to get email. And the email you would get in those days ran to two pages, and I used to get it from professors and people like that. Marvelously intelligent, literate stuff. And I thought, this is it. And I, to this day, I'm still an internet utopian, and I look back fondly at those times, when everything on the internet was sweetness and light.
The world's changed. And I mean, one of the other massive things in 25 years, I suppose, the biggest news event of the last quarter century was probably 9/11. And I think everybody remembers where they were when they heard about it. I was on the M62 driving back from a radio station in Huddersfield. Where were you that day? Were you asleep?
It was 1:30 in the afternoon. And because it was a Tuesday and I had a routine, and I had got up about 1:00 in the afternoon after doing the night shift. And I was taking myself off to lunch at this nice little bar on Balham High Road called the Picture and Piano. And so I popped in there, and everybody's looking at the television, and they're looking at a picture of the World Trade Center, of One World Trade Center, and it's kind of got smoke coming out of it. And I said to the guy, and I looked at this for about 20 seconds. I said, what's happened? They said, a plane's flown in to the World Trade Center. I said, have you got a phone? He said, yes. So I picked up the phone, got on the phone to my producer, Howard Benson. And I said, do you want to go? And he said, you can't go. I said, okay. Do you want to come in? He said, no, don't come in yet, but just keep across it. And, we'll just roll with this when we get it. I said, okay, fine. So that's what we did. And of course we couldn't go because they'd already closed the airspace. You couldn't have a flight to New York. There would be no such thing, as it turned out, for 6 days. So we kept on the story from the London end, and we just kept pushing to make sure that we got everything on and all the angles that we could think of covering, because of course we still had telephones, and we weren't shy of using telephones. The BBC had for a long time had a very sniffy attitude to phone box radio, as we called it, but we didn't, and we just kept everybody on the phones. I said, Howard, do you know there's this big charter going? He said, yes, I know. It hasn't gone for 3 days. I said, okay. There's a BBC charter. They're waiting out at Stansted. And every day, people used to go out there in hope to Stansted and wait. And they couldn't go because the ban hadn't been lifted. We got a wonderful BBC travel agent, a lovely guy called Dave Bristow, and he booked us and just kept rolling the booking until the ban was lifted. So I think it was a Saturday morning, Howard and I, maybe it was a Friday morning, but anyway, we found ourselves on the second flight out of Heathrow going to New York. And that was how we got in.
Wow. And then the coverage that you did from there presumably was quite moving.
Oh, it's, well, moved us.
I've just seen something that I haven't seen with my own eyes before. This is really quite difficult to believe. My guess is we're about four city blocks from what they're now calling Ground Zero. And instead of these shining towers, what you're seeing instead is a black pile. It's a bit like one of these Indian funeral pyres, to be honest. It's about 100 feet high. It's surmounted by a crane. It seems to be topped by sort of melted iron, and it's smoking. And you've seen pictures of it, but it's a really odd thing to see it in the light and to see it framed in the back by the other tall buildings that remain here, and know that that was once the tallest of them all. And we're looking down the street, and as we're looking, there are workers coming back up, there are people going on down. We'll go down a little bit further, but in a sense, our job is done here, because I haven't got a camera, and this is probably the best I can do. I don't know if there's anything you want to add.
Well, the only thing that I would add to it is that pile is filled with people.
You know, I think the thing that moved me the most, I had lost my younger brother a couple of years before, and I went to the Far Rockaways. Now, the Far Rockaways are not called the Far Rockaways for nothing. They are the most distant part of Long Island, and they're very, it takes you forever to get there. And I foolishly took a cab from Midtown to go and talk to a firefighter the brother of a firefighter who had been lost in the tower collapse. And this taxi ride cost a fortune and took forever, and the taxi driver didn't know where he was going. But anyway, I got there, and I just, you know, the guy just opened up, and he was beside himself. And I think it was the closest that I got and the closest that I felt to anybody who had lost somebody in the World Trade Center. There were a lot of stories of loss, and a lot of things that we had to really try and stay with for that next year. You know, we didn't just treat this as a terrible thing that's happened, now let's move on, which I think, to our great discredit in the news business, we so often do, but we really, really tried to follow up.
And it was on a break in the States, not long after 9/11, that you decided you were going to move back there. So you'd been dragged back to London in the 80s by your wife and her work, and you decided to take her back to the States.
Yeah, that's very true. This was I was born in July, therefore I'm a Cancer. Therefore, I never attack a problem by going forwards. I only attack a problem by going sideways. So for a long time before 9/11. I had been promised a gift of a sabbatical. And I will tell your listeners that I have been promised a gift of a sabbatical again, which I'm going to take this summer, which I'm absolutely thrilled about. But anyway, I had this sabbatical on the cards. And of course, it was pushed back and it was much, much shorter. But we found a little house by a pond in the middle of Massachusetts. I didn't know much about Massachusetts. I'd barely been there. But it sounded romantic, and it was only 12 miles away from Walden Pond, where Henry Thoreau walked around and thought great thoughts. And I thought, well, if Henry Thoreau did it, maybe, you know, maybe magic will happen twice. It didn't quite, but it was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. And I then became fascinated with the history of New England and the place. It was not an overnight move by any means. In fact, it was carried out with care, shall we say, because nobody, the whole point was, I mean, my belief about radio is it doesn't really matter where you are. It matters that you're there. Nobody's listening to you in the middle of the night going, I wonder where he is today, unless you've made a virtue of it. And my whole object was to say, you're the person that matters. You as the listener are the person that matters. And you and I are in this together from our different places, wherever we are. I don't know where you are. You don't know where I am necessarily. So, okay, we went on like this. And I must have started in this little town of Marblehead, which we came to quite by chance, I must admit. But we were kind of, once we arrived, you know, the drawbridge went up and we couldn't get out. It was rather wonderful the way that people embraced us, and we were so very, very welcomed. Anyway, I'd start with, I think, a week of experimental broadcasting from the local radio station, which was the owner had just been wonderful to me. He just gave me the keys. He said, we go home at 4:30. You come in at 4:30. What could be better? So I'd start at 4:30 in the afternoon, and I'd wire up everything. And we had hairy moments. And, you know, if you've ever done anything involving remote broadcasting, first of all, you needed in the 1990s something called an ISDN line. Well, they had an ISDN, so that was gold. So I had an ISDN box. That was terrific. We then used the telephone line to connect to the internet, and we used another line for fax in case the internet went down, which it frequently did. I mean, to this day, I still don't know how we actually did that as seamlessly, but we really, really did. And I'm so grateful to all of my colleagues who helped make this possible.
This was at WESX, is that right?
WESX on the North Shore, yes. And then WESX, as is the fate And you know, this is radio today, the fate of so many little local radio stations. It was sold and it just closed. And it was sold to a property developer in the end, who bought it for a song in radio terms. You know, maybe I don't actually know what was paid for it, but it wasn't a tremendous amount of money. And then the land was turned into housing and the developer made a little fortune. So unfortunately, our station, and I looked at this station, I thought, gosh, could I be a radio station owner with a large mortgage, of course. And I thought, I don't know where this is going. I don't know where this business is going, because local advertising even then was shrinking. And it was, that was the essential problem, that it became a, first of all, a signal was taken into a combined
Spanish,
signal.
Spanish, yes,
that's right.
Station,
Spanish. This is a Spanish music station by day and a Christian broadcasting station by night. It was a sort of a schizophrenic sort of thing. If you look for the call sign now, I think it's been blended into the call sign of a station in Lynn, Massachusetts, so it doesn't even exist.
So now, in the last 12 years or so, you've been doing it from your house in Marblehead. In terms of the move and doing it remotely, how was it welcomed by bosses? They wanted to keep you on, I guess, did they? Were you saying, I'm moving to the States, see you later?
They must have. I mean, really, anybody else, I can't believe it. To this day, never mention my name to anybody in BBC Human Resources. They just blench at the sound. For them, you don't want to discuss me with them, that's for sure. So it was all beautifully handled. And I must just take my hat off to my various controllers who said, well, look, you know, just don't tell me if it's going well. If you have a problem, let me know. And I won't mention them by name, but you can easily work it out. And they're both still with BBC, in fact, as far as I know. And one of them has just become extremely elevated. So I definitely won't be mentioning him, but he is a lovely, lovely man. So we proceeded. And first of all, we had a little pied-à-terre here. And I was broadcasting from the kitchen counter. And again, because this is radio today, I just, you know, tip my hat to the Electra Voice microphone, which I use, because I use it at like about a 1-inch distance. And that means that all the extraneous noise can be blocked out, you know, so you can do it from a place that might have some echo. And where we are now, it's well soundproofed. But initially, I wasn't quite so sure that it was going to be perfect. So the Electra Voice really saved me. And I was standing there at the kitchen counter. I think the thing that people didn't know was that sometimes without air conditioning in that little apartment, it would get up to around about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And I'd be standing there with a towel around my neck and not much else. But the show must go on. And so it jolly well did. So I moved to more comfortable surroundings.
And more comfortable time, because it's generally 8 till midnight when you do your show, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. So, you know, that's absolutely wonderful. The only time that it slightly changes is, funnily enough, right now, because the UK has already gone to summertime.
No, not yet. Next week.
Well, that's right. That's right. It's the other way around. The US has gone to summertime and the UK hasn't. So we're only 4 hours adrift at the moment, which means that I have to stay up to 1 o'clock in the morning, ugh, which is just about when I used to start. Boy, that's hard.
And technically, it all works out. You did use ISDN, but you don't, you know, that's stopped being supported now. So you're on broadband.
That's right. You know, and ISDN has now been orphaned, I think, by most of the big telcos in the United States, including mine. So we've moved to IPCOM and we're using a lovely unit, which, you know, is even easier, frankly, to use an ISDN, because the line so rarely glitches or garbles, you know, and I'm touching a bit of wood, obviously. And if you need to refresh it, you just drop it off and push the button again. And the whole thing can be accomplished in a couple of seconds. We're awfully lucky now, I think, with the technology we've got.
Yeah, we've had some contributors on this podcast in recent weeks from London, and the quality of their line's not been as good as this one to you. So
it's amazing, isn't it? You know, but of course, that is the other thing, that cable is so ubiquitous in American cities. It's expensive as a consumer, but it means you've got this vast bandwidth, you know, and whereas on providers in Britain, you're still kind of looking at, I've got sort of 20 megs now. Here people go, have you got 100? Have you got 150? Oh, somebody over there has got 1,000. You know, there are much, much bigger bandwidths routinely available so that we get this great quality.
And there are probably many presenters in the BBC and commercial radio quite jealous of you that you're allowed to sit at home in your attic at a sensible time of day. And, you know, if the boss is listening, I'm looking out of my window now in my little studio at the Leeds Liverpool Canal in Yorkshire. I'd love to be up all night reading the news from here, but I don't think they'd let me. So you're very lucky in that respect.
Well, I mean, you know, my goodness me. And may I just say that my role model in this was Desmond Carrington.
Yes, from the far north of Scotland.
For Radio 2 from the farm in Perthshire. And he often used to, I mean, Desmond used to make a virtue of where he was. He used to say, I'm on my farm and here's all the lovely things I've been doing today. And I think that worked for his audience. That was really important. I'm not about to start saying in kind of loving Technicolor what I've done today, because I know how hard it is to be up in the middle of the night. And I've been there, you know. But by the same token, my humble opinion, if I wasn't here and if I'd still been trying to do it from the UK, I'd probably be pushing up daisies around about now. So let's just say it's a lesser of two evils.
And obviously, being kind of a far distance away, but connected now because of the internet and technology, what perspective does that give you on the world that you're able to bring as a broadcaster, do you think?
Do you remember the Eagle comic and this evil character called the Meekon? He used to terrify Dan Dare. And the Meekon was a little green man, and he used to sit on this kind of flying saucery thing, which permanently hovered about 6 feet off the ground. And I kind of feel a bit like the Meekon. You know, I feel that because of technology, I'm hovering somewhere between the Irish coast and the coast of Labrador. You know, I'm in a kind of nowhere zone in a way, because I don't feel I'm particularly grounded in the US, even although obviously we look for our stories here because this is where people are awake and this is where they speak English. You know, there's no mystery about why we have so much American coverage, because this is where we can find guests. And if you've got 4 hours to fill a night, you're going to have to find guests who are willing to do this. Otherwise, you're going to have to record slabs with people in the UK during the day. And that rather defeats the point of being up all night. So, you know, it's what you make it. I feel great closeness to both places. That's what I really want to say. I don't feel equal distance from both places. I feel equal connection to both places.
Yeah, and your listeners, they're generally trying to get to sleep or trying to stay awake. So
yeah.
it's a hard
job. Yeah.
It's quite hard to kind of fit both missions, really.
Well, I think you just have to speak softly. That way, you know, if you're trying to stay awake, you'll listen hard. And if you're trying to go to sleep, you know, I'm not going to get too excited. And I mean, the one thing I would say, and I lost this battle an awfully long time ago, I said, don't you think we should play quieter jingles in the middle of the night? And we never, ever won that one. You know, we get these kind of rambunctious things that tell you about how something is going to be big and bouncy and wonderful and it's the best football match that there's ever been. And this may be more appropriate at other times of the day. But anyway, we get through it. It's our station sound. It's a much bigger thing than one program.
And I know from driving into radio stations to start at 5 a.m, there's a lot of radio people listening on their way in to get a dose of the news before they get into work. Yeah, so you've got a lot of fans in the radio industry for that reason, because we do funny shifts.
Oh, I know. I feel your pain. And I've done earlys, and I never liked it very much. I remember doing earlys in Leeds for a while, going into Radio Leeds when I was on attachment there in the 70s. And, you know, you'd be standing at the bus stop in the freezing cold at, you know, 5:30 or something in the morning. And that wasn't a lot of fun. But I sorted it when I went to Dundee. I did do some earlys at Radio Tay. But mostly I did the late shift. So I would come in the middle of the day and then work through until, you know, the mid-evening, as it turned out.
And I just wanted to ask you as well, I know you had a discussion on Up All Night fairly recently about the big changes in UK radio at the moment, where we're getting networked breakfast shows here. Of course, in the States, that's something that's been going on for a long time. You've got people Elvis Duran who are on, you know, 50, 60, 70 radio stations at breakfast time. So
that's it.
We're turning into the American radio networks, are we?
You know, I wonder what the solution is. I don't know that there is. I look at, you know, my radio listening comes from the Boston metropolitan area now, and there are big local newsrooms here still, although something like WBZ, which is a big AM station, was recently taken over by iHeartRadio. So quite a few people were let go, and I know a lot of people grieve the old way of WBZ. But still, they're still on the air. If you look at the NPR stations, what they've done, their solution is to have local opt-outs. Frankly, I mean, I'm in awe of the NPR funding model, because not only are they able to appeal to you, it seems like every other week, for money and give you a huge guilt complex if you're listening without having pledged your $10 a month, they also get magnificent foundation grants and occasionally, just occasionally, huge gifts. And the Woolworth billionaire, you know, was terribly important to NPR in their foundation for their coverage over the last 10 years. So I like the way that NPR is funded. I'm not suggesting necessarily that we, the BBC, ought to be going that way. But obviously there are a great many discussions at the moment about how the BBC is going to be funded in the future. It might not be the same.
So they're marking 25 years of you at Five Live with 25 special podcasts. What have you picked out as your best moments?
Well, exactly. I mean, the latest intelligence I have is there might even be even more than 25 podcasts. We have no idea. I just found everything I could. And so we've got this kind of wonderful assembly of stuff that sometimes I'd completely forgotten about. For example, I mean, I was just voicing up something that I did for the inauguration of Barack Obama. And that was an early morning to beat all early mornings. I think I had to be at the station about 5 o'clock. And already it was quite hard to find a seat on the metro going into Washington, D.C. But you know, we talked to all these people. I talked to all these people. It was one of these kind of lone wolf jobs. And I talked to all these people on the mall, put it all together. And it was great to see the pride with which people who had never been to an inauguration before greeted the arrival of Mr. Obama or Mr. and Mrs. Obama. And there was great fondness for them in that huge crowd.
During the civil rights movement, the grandmothers took their grandchildren. It wasn't an option. Their grandchildren marched with them. They were trained to march. And the second reason is, I was telling him on the way down, when his father was born, the buses going south were segregated, very much segregated. So this is a very historic moment for not only America, but the entire world. And I wanted to share it with him.
Oh, isn't that great? Well, how do you feel right now?
I feel cool. It's the inauguration, Obama. He won it, so he deserves this. He's going to talk. I think it's going to be a very big event.
Help you God. Congratulations,
Mr. President. Well, congratulations, you've got a new president.
Congratulations to President Obama and his gift to be simple and free.
And faithful, obviously, although he had to have another go at that.
Bring it on!
I was standing here on this ground in 1963 when Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his message. I was maybe 100 feet from where he spoke. You know, I thought maybe that dream had fell on deaf ears, but it hadn't. But I think America is coming to fruition. Thank you, sir.
It's special. And I think that this country will be better served because of his election.
There's lots of stuff. There's me learning to salsa. This was my father's most favorite piece of radio that I ever did, was me and this kind of very sexy voiced Latin lady learning to salsa. So that's going to be somewhere in this little brand tub of podcasts. And I think it's a lucky dip. You put your hand in and you're not quite sure what you'll pull out. But I've always loved that quality about our program too.
Well, best of luck for the next 25 years on Up All Night. And good luck with your sabbatical in the summer as well. A well-earned rest, I guess, for you.
Thank you, Stuart.
I'm James Cridland, the radio futurologist. Never assume, we're told, in internal training days. To assume, we're told, makes an ass out of you and me. And so we laughed. And we had another biscuit. And we willed the rest of the day to finish. In radio, we assume too often. Mainly, we assume that all our audience are like us. In 1993, I was told off by my programme director at the time for back-announcing a song with a reference to the video. My assumption was that everyone listening was like us, with satellite TV and access to the music channels. He reminded me correctly that they weren't. We also assume that others are like us with the other technology we have. Most people we know own an iPhone, so we assume that iPhones are in use everywhere. And that would be a mistake. In fact, 80% of the world uses Android phones, and even where Apple is strongest in places like the US and Australia, Apple only has 55% or so of the market. In terms of smart speakers, too, you'd assume that Amazon Echo devices are the leader. We've seen lots of data from the US telling us so, and they are. In the US. But in Australia, Google has a 68% market share of smart speakers in the home. Amazon Echo devices are comparatively small. The Wise would spend time getting their stations to work properly on Google speakers, not Amazon ones. And then people assume that sales of speakers tell the whole story. Google Assistant powers everything from Google speakers to Android mobile phones. I have two sets of headphones with Google Assistant inside them. My Chromebook now has Google Assistant built in as well. And you can guess that Google Assistant is coming to other things too, like televisions, cars, and more. The best thing to do is to look at the data, see if you can spot the trends coming out of new technology, and understand what most people do, not what the people around you are doing right now. The one thing we do know is that radio's habitual nature means it's surprisingly slow to change, far slower than anyone thinks. But that's not to say that change won't come. I'll be trying my hardest not to assume anything when I'm at the NAB show shortly. I'll assume that the monorail will have queues to get on, and I'll assume that it'll be impossible to find a decent cup of coffee anywhere. But in terms of the tech, I'll try really hard not to assume anything. You can get my weekly newsletter at james.crid.land and daily podcast news at podnews.net. And until next time, keep listening. And now on the Radio Today programme, here's David Lloyd. Radio
Moments! As commercial radio across the UK changes yet again, let's remember that it's now 10 years this week since the Heart brand took in a further 12 stations across the west of England, bringing to 24 the number of Hearts. So it was farewell to some familiar radio brands. All hits! Fox Hill.
News and information for Exeter and East Devon. This is Gemini FM.
South Ham's Radio. GWR. As the Heart brand grew, farewell to Orchard, Seven Sound, Gemini, GWR, Lantern and Plymouth Sound. That traffic jingle, by the way, was Plymouth Sound's Lest Anyone Else Gets Blamed. Now, when that all happened 10 years ago, the press was saying also, here we are, Guardian, column here by Johnny D. It says, Heart is the sound of radio if rock had never happened. And it goes on to say, continuing the search for perfect radio channels, we turn to Heart, a station that's everywhere around us, like exhaust fumes. Oh dear, they don't like it, do they? Here we are, lovely Toby Anstis is mentioned here. Few people could have a surname less suitable for radio, or indeed a voice less suitable for radio. Poor Toby, how can anyone say that about him? Lovely man. So there we are, that's Heart rolling out. It now, of course, has 8.5 million listeners, doesn't it? 1974 now, and a new arrival at Radio 1.
The Happy Sun! Radio 1.
And a very good morning to you. Chart day, of course, today. 12:45, we'll be getting to that chart. It's just ahead of the number one, the top 40 countdown at 1 o'clock. The Ramones.
I took over from Roscoe. Roscoe had this Saturday show, and I, talked too fast, rabbited my way through it. Obviously, it was okay, because I carried on doing that. And then from then on, Johnny Walker refused to play the Bay City Rollers. Sort of left on that to, you know, and he's a lovely guy, I know Johnny, but I could never understand why he'd put your life, because basically the Rollers would be dead in a few months. That's the nature of those, you know. If you're on a top 40 station, you can't not play the whatever's, you know. So anyway, he went off to the States, and I got his job.
Ultravox in Vienna. That's the number two record of the moment. Kim Wilde hasn't made it yet, but I really think she's going to with this sound.
Paul Burnett, who began at Radio 1 this week in 1974. Commentary is a real art, isn't it? Let's enjoy this classic example here from 70 years ago this week. It's the boat race. John Snagg is in the commentary launch, and his boat sadly falls behind the action just before Hammersmith Bridge, so he can't really see who's finishing first.
They're coming up now. They're both crews ripping up the stroke and coming into rail fighting finish. They're both crews that obviously had the most grueling race, one of the greatest races that had ever been, and the perfect conditions too. Oxford in the lead, I think. I don't know, but I think. It's almost neck and neck. It's level, I should think. I'm not quite sure. It must be level. Cambridge picking up the stroke. I think Cambridge are ahead. I don't know who's ahead. It's either Oxford or Cambridge. It's neck and neck the whole way over. There's about less than 100 yards to go.
The BBC's John Snagg, and the most famous of his 37 boat race commentaries this week, 70 years ago. John actually died this week in 1996. It's not often the travel person gets a right royal send-off from a radio station, but Lynn Bowles did when she left Radio 2 this week last year.
We still haven't got over it.
Oh,
honestly,
no,
what have you
on,
done
you're gonna
to
be
us?
Fine. You're going to be fine.
I'm not sure about that at
I'm
all.
Like therapy
I'm just,
here.
I'm just going to have to throw myself on some dear old standbys, like. Oh, I'll always think of you.
Oh, thanks.
Whenever Ken. I hear that, or. Oh, well, that's better.
Always like. Brings me to mind, doesn't
yes,
it?
We yes, are we're going to miss you terribly from BBC Radio 2.
And I'm going to miss you as well, because anybody who leaves a company, a firm, a so-called corporation, knows that it's never about the job in the end. It's not about the job. It's about the people you work with. And the best thing about Radio 2, it's not just about the people I work with. It's about the people who listened as well.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Who contributed and who have shown how much they appreciated the work I've done. And I have been shocked and stunned by that. And I am very, very grateful to everyone I've worked with and to everyone who's listened.
Oh, stop it now.
Lynn Bowles leaving the Ken Bruce Show this week last year. It can't really be 25 years since Five Live launched, can it?
Good morning. Welcome to a new network, Radio 5 Live. News and sport from the BBC, 24 hours a day. It's 5 o'clock.
It was at 5 o'clock this morning that 5 Live came on the air. Its first voice, that of Jane Garvey, presenter of Morning Reports. 3 hours later, with the breakfast show in its stride, the champagne was opened for journalists from other media who'd come to watch and hear the network's first morning on air. Media watchers from the national newspapers were largely impressed with what they'd heard so far. The Guardian's media correspondent, Andrew Culph.
I think it made a very confident start. Launches are always difficult for radio stations, but it came on air this morning sounding very crisp, very friendly and very accessible, and I think that was the note they were trying to strike.
Those less keen on sport, like Jane Thin of the Daily Telegraph, were less enthralled.
From what I've heard, I now know more than I ever needed to know about Manchester United's defeat. But at the same time, there's some strange items like eating disorders and prejudice against black and Asians by the police force in Leicester. And it does make you think, who is this trying to appeal to?
It makes me think about who media journalists appeal to. But there we go. In New York, one of the biggest radio names was Don Imus. And this week last year, he said farewell on air after 50 years.
But I'll tell you what I've been thinking about. I thought I was going to have some more time to think about what this meant, stopping doing this. Because somebody said, well are you going to miss this? And I didn't have an answer. But I do now. I'm not going to miss doing the Imus and Wayne program. It's been a lot of fun, but, man, it's hard to do. I mean, I know this in my heart. I've always thought this. There's been nobody ever better on the radio than me, and I mean that. And I'm not patting myself on the back or anything. I'm just telling you. I'm telling you how it is. Nobody ever did this. Nobody. But it wasn't me who did it. And this is may sound patronizing, but you know me, and you know it's not. You know what I'm going to miss you.
The great Don Imus. It's 29 years since the Radio 1 chart show stopped borrowing Radio 2's FM space because it now had its own.
Radio 1 FM. Don't forget, this is the last week you'll be able to hear Radio 1's Top 40 on Radio 2's FM frequencies. From next Sunday, you'll have to retune to Radio 1's own part of the FM band between 97 and 99.
Bruno Brooks stopping surprising Radio 2 listeners on FM this week in 1990. So, with Real Radio Yorkshire launching 17 years ago.
We're here, we're finally here. Hello.
The final Libby Purvis midweek on Radio 4 2 years ago.
Today, this is the last midweek, as in an elegant parallel, our leader has triggered a sort of Article 15 Wexit.
The West Midlands local stations becoming free radio 7 years ago.
Nothing's changed, only the name.
Richard Skinner leaving Radio 1 33 years ago.
It's 12 noon in London.
And Radio Caroline launching from the North Sea 55 years ago.
Hello and happy Easter to all of you. This is Christopher Moore with the first record program on Radio Caroline. The first record is by the Rolling Stones, and I'd like to play it for all of the people who worked to put the station on the air, and particularly for Ronan.
Those are this week's radio moments.
Thank you, David, and regulars James and Roy. Well done to you if you made it right to the end of the podcast this week. And thank you to my special guest, Rod Sharp. We'll be back with more next week, including possibly a hookup with Radio Days Europe.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.